In October 2020, the Saudi authorities announced that they were working on the notorious kafala, or sponsorship system, described by critics as modern-day slavery. Under the kafala system, the legal status of migrant workers is controlled by their employers, leaving them prone to abuse and exploitation. Right now, almost one-third of the kingdom's 34 million people are composed of migrant workers, and almost half of that number work as drivers. It's hard to believe that these drivers of luxury cars are among the most vulnerable in Saudi Arabia, but that is the reality less reported. While Riyadh has promised to roll out the kafala reforms in March this year, these reforms don't apply to the 3.7 million domestic workers, as they're excluded from the kingdom's labor law.
I think they are a cosmetic exercise because the fundamental relationship doesn't change. The laborer is still tied to the sponsor. Only after 12 months of working there can they change jobs, and they have to do that through a long process through the Saudi authorities. So there's no real change. It looks very cosmetic.
This means all these workers will remain at the mercy of their employers, with the least possible, if any, legal protection. According to Al Iqtisadiya newspaper, drivers in the kingdom make up 55% of the domestic workers. Many of them complain that their employers delay, deduct, or don't pay their salaries for up to 6 months at a time. That's why they are forced to work for long hours and exposed to verbal and psychological abuse. Some of these drivers say they work 18 hours a day without a day off, a violation of the kingdom's domestic worker regulation. The fact is, these drivers, as part of domestic workers, are trapped. There's no real will from the authorities to protect them against abuse or exploitation. In the words of Rathna Begum of Human Rights Watch, we have documented situations of domestic workers who have been confined to their employers' homes, their passports confiscated, forced to work excessive hours without rest or days off, and they happen to be subject to very specific forms of abuse, such as physical and sexual abuse.
Well, I think for domestic servants and labourers and drivers, this type of thing is common, and it's well documented by human rights organisations that this exploitation and abuse is going on. And sometimes we have high profile cases where that's happening. So I think there's no doubt that this is happening, and it's happening on a large scale within the Saudi Arabia, but also in other Gulf countries as well.
In November last year, Human Rights Watch interviewed a number of Indian and Pakistani drivers who work for private employers in Saudi Arabia. Their first-hand accounts draw a grim picture of the situation that they have to face every day. One of them says, "I have to work continuously from 7 a.m. until well after midnight." Another one says, "When they no longer need me to run their own errands, they send me to the madam's sister's house to run her errands." Another driver says, "It's like they own me, so they must use me every moment. Most days I do not have time to eat a proper lunch."
This is essentially a capitalist system of exploitation of human labor, where the laborers have no rights. They can't change without anybody's permission, and the Saudis can't build their economy without this. So they are basically it's a coerced system of labor, which relies on the fact that many people will come because their own countries are so poor that this system at least gives them a little bit of a wage. Of course, if their own countries were much more economically developed, nobody would work under these conditions.
In just another case, which shows the gravity of the situation for these foreign drivers, one Pakistani driver talks about his Saudi employer's behavior after an accident he had for which he was not responsible. He tells Human Rights Watch, "My employer has withheld my monthly salary of 1,200 Saudi riyals, that's $319 US, ever since as punishment. Because my employer is angry that I had an accident, my family back home is starving. I am starving. I don't have money to eat a proper meal."
I think we can't expect to see any improvement because basically the Saudi economy, like other Gulf economies, is built on this kind of exploitative labor, and therefore they are planning this new city and they have built their current infrastructure through this system. It's a very capitalist system which exploits migrant labor, treats them more or less as property to be abused and used, and they can't build their economies without this labor, but their aim is to maximize the profits and the wealth available to the investors, who tend to be rich, wealthy Saudi families or businesses or corporations.
Due to the exploitative practices from their Saudi employers, these migrant workers, already in debt, may end up in a worse condition. Speaking from experience, these drivers say it's a waste of time to file a lawsuit against their employers. According to the driver who has had the accident, it is useful to go to the Makote Bala Amal labor office. The men there are ruder and even less cooperative than my own employer.
Well, the Saudi legal system is exploitative of laborers, migrant laborers in particular, and the whole economy and the infrastructure is built on this modern day type of exploitation of labor. And this it doesn't work in their favor. They are seen as second class citizens, and that's how they're treated.
Most of these drivers live in constant fear as they don't know what to do in a foreign country where migrant rights are not strict in practice. These drivers have to drive a long road before they reach a safe destination. For all these reform claims made by the Saudi authorities amount to real changes.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
The European Union has threatened to block exports of coronavirus vaccines to countries outside the European bloc, countries such as Britain, after AstraZeneca was accused of failing to give a satisfactory explanation for a huge shortfall of promised doses to member states. The pharmaceutical company's new distribution plans were said to be unacceptable after it surprisingly informed the European Commission on Friday, 22nd of January, that there would be significant shortfalls on the original schedule. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Daniel Buffy. The piece is titled, European Union Threatens to Block COVID Vaccine Exports Amid AstraZeneca Shortfall. Stay with us for more of Daniel Buffy's article. The European Union has threatened to block exports of coronavirus vaccines to countries outside the European bloc, countries such as Britain, after AstraZeneca was accused of failing to give a satisfactory explanation for a huge shortfall of promised doses to European member states. The pharmaceutical company's new distribution plans were said to be unacceptable after it surprisingly informed the European Commission on Friday, 22nd of January, that there would be significant shortfalls on the original schedule. The European Union has been due to receive 100 million doses of the vaccine in the first quarter of this year, but it is feared that the bloc will only receive half of that despite making large advance purchases ahead of authorization of the vaccine by the European Medicines Agency. In a heated telephone conversation with AstraZeneca's chief executive, Pascal Soriot, on Monday, the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the company must live up to its contractual obligations. The European Medicines Agency is expected to authorize the AstraZeneca vaccine by the end of this week. Ursula von der Leyen's spokesperson said she made it clear that she expects AstraZeneca to deliver on the contractual arrangements foreseen in the advance purchasing agreement. She reminded Pascal Soriot that the European Union has invested significant amounts in the company up front precisely to ensure that production is ramped up even before the conditional market authorization is delivered by the European Medicines Agency. Of course, production issues can appear with the complex vaccine, but we expect the company to find solutions and to exploit all possible flexibilities to deliver swiftly. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, made a televised statement to express her frustration at the company's behaviour, warning that the answers so far provided by AstraZeneca had not been satisfactory. Late on Monday evening, 25th of January, following discussions with executives representing the pharmaceutical company, the European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, tweeted, "Discussions with AstraZeneca today resulted in dissatisfaction with a lack of clarity and insufficient explanations from the company. European Union member states are united. Vaccine developers have societal and contractual responsibilities they need to uphold. With our member states, we have requested from AstraZeneca a detailed planning of vaccine deliveries and when distribution will take place to member states. Another meeting will be convened on Wednesday to discuss the matter further." The development has raised pressure on the Commission, just as it is being criticized for the slow rollout of vaccination programs in European Union member states in comparison with the United Kingdom and the United States. The United Kingdom has administered more than 10 doses per 100 residents, but according to data gathered by Airfinity, a London-based life sciences analytics company, the European Union has administered just under 2 doses per 100 residents. The EU Health Commissioner Stella Kyriakides said Brussels would now insist on being notified of any exports of vaccines from EU sites, including that produced by Pfizer, on which the United Kingdom is reliant on European laboratories for supplies, raising the specter of an export ban. Kyriakides said, "You know that AstraZeneca vaccine is currently in the final stages of approval with the European Medicines Agency. If all requirements are met, the European Medicines Agency could recommend market authorization by the end of this week. But there is a problem in the supply side. Last Friday, the company, AstraZeneca, surprisingly informed the European Commission and the European Union member states that it intends to supply considerably fewer doses of the vaccine in the coming weeks than agreed and announced. This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. That is why I wrote a letter to the company at the weekend in which I asked important and serious questions. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return." The EU Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the European Union wanted to know exactly which doses have been produced where by AstraZeneca so far, and if or to whom they have been delivered. These questions were also discussed today in the Joint Steering Board of the Commission and the 27 member states with AstraZeneca, she said. "The answers of the company have not been satisfactory so far. That's why a second meeting is scheduled for tonight. The European Union wants the order and pre-financed doses to be delivered as soon as possible, and we want our contract to be fully fulfilled." The European Union has spent €2.7 billion on the rapid development and production of coronavirus vaccines. The European Union's Health Commissioner, Stella Kyriakides, said the Commission had proposed that the member states agreed on an export transparency mechanism be put in place as soon as possible. Meanwhile, Germany's Health Minister, Jens Spahn, gave Berlin's backing to the Commission proposal. "We, as the European Union, must be able to know whether and what vaccines are being exported from the European Union," he said. "Only that way can we understand whether our European Union contracts with the producers are being served fairly. An obligation to get approval for vaccine exports on the European Union level makes sense." AstraZeneca said in a statement that the company's chief executive, in his conversation with Ursula von der Leyen, had stressed the importance of working in partnership and how AstraZeneca is doing everything it can to bring its vaccine to millions of Europeans as soon as possible.
It's very rare that a former leader publicly criticizes or provides advice to his or her successor, and is often something that protocol frowns upon when it's done. However, this has not stopped the former Labour Chancellor and Prime Minister Gordon Brown from doing so, leaving Boris Johnson red-faced in the process. So intense has the criticism been that Gordon Brown has stated that Britain is becoming a failed state, not only through the poor mishandling of various crises by the British government, but also because of the ever-widening and deepening divisions within the British socio-political system. It seems that Brown has placed the blame squarely at the feet of Boris Johnson, suggesting that the Prime Minister is so alienated from the reality in which British people are living that he has lost scope of how British feel on a variety of issues and everyday problems. One of the main reasons for the disparity is the divide between the Conservative Party and the people, a division that's traditionally seen different classes voting for different parties in the UK, with the working class commonly leaning towards Labour and the upper middle class swinging towards the Tories, hence leading to a lack of communication between the ruling party and the majority of people in Britain. One such example of just how divided the UK are as a population is the opinion on Brexit. With such a slim divide between those wishing to leave the EU and remain, the difference of opinion of people across the whole of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and the north of Ireland is already fractured, without raising the notion of nationalism and separatism into the equation. So when the element of nationalism is introduced into the argument, for example, in the case of Scotland, is former Prime Minister Gordon Brown right when he says that the UK is on the verge of becoming a failed state? And if so, just how serious is the problem?
It's obvious that the present system isn't working. When you have one of the constituent nations, Scotland, and the other, completely at odds with the capital and the sort of the economic core of the country, then it obviously the system is not working. A political system hasn't just to represent a numerical majority. It has to represent all sectors of society and all regions of a country. And this current system is obviously failing to do so.
Back in 2014, the majority of Scots rejected the idea of having an independent Scotland, for the country was benefiting from EU budgets allocated to its agriculture, economy, and education sectors. However, now that Britain has left the EU, Scots see themselves empty-handed and are highly considering rejoining the EU once again. Scottish First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has repeatedly stated that she would push for a second referendum if her party wins a majority in May elections. Sturgeon has insisted on her country's political independence by stating that Westminster's consent to the move is not their priority, for it's for the people of Scotland to choose and not the lawmakers in Westminster. Latest poll shows that nearly half of the people in Scotland are now in favour of an independent country, a figure that's likely to increase even more as Scots see less benefits flow into their country, and Scottish nationalism is significantly on the rise, hence putting the Scottish people much closer to the option of voting for such a move.
Well, yes, because the last referendum they had was under completely different circumstances. Britain was part of the European Union. Scotland and the Scots were very happy Europeans, and they liked it that way. When Britain left the European Union, they were left, defenceless and without allies in the face of an overweening London capital. So, yeah, they're entitled to ask for it. Whether they should get it or not, is whether they should, is another story. Once the time comes, vote for independence.
Some of the problems that Britain is struggling with in its post-Brexit era and the widening political and social inequality have encouraged other countries within the UK to consider leaving, for they believe that they're better off on their own. Current polls indicate that over half the people of the north of Ireland welcome the idea of holding a referendum on a united Ireland. Also in Wales, people are starting to back the idea of holding a referendum on independence, spelling the inevitable breakup of the United Kingdom in the process. Can Boris Johnson's Conservative government, therefore, reunite a divided Britain? Or has the pendulum swung too far past the tipping point, taking Britain towards a collapsed failed state full of internal division?
Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States on January 20th during an inauguration ceremony that wasn't attended by his predecessor, Donald Trump. The reason for that absence was made clear just hours after when Biden signed over a dozen executive orders reversing policies adopted by the previous U.S. administration. The Biden administration says it will roll back Trump's policies that are harmful to Americans and to the rest of the world. The new president signed an order lifting the so-called Muslim ban. The U.S. will rejoin the Paris Agreement on climate change and cancel the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden has also taken action on the COVID-19 pandemic and signed an executive order to rejoin the World Health Organization. Absent from the announced Biden 100-day program, however, is any proposed reversals of Israel policies implemented by the Trump administration that risk security concerns of a global scale, including moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, extorting Arab countries to recognize Israel, U.S. recognition of Golan Heights as part of Israel, U.S. support for Israeli annexation of the West Bank, and the assassination of foreign figures.
Anything you want to do in the United States as president or Congress or almost any part of government, you need Israeli permission. You know, Israel is the one that allows you to do things and puts a veto on anything they don't like. It's very unusual for the United States to do something that Israel doesn't like. And in this case, Israel doesn't want to reverse any of these policies.
In his confirmation session in the Senate, Biden's pick for Secretary of State Anthony Blinken stresses support for a two-state solution to the Palestinian problem. But he remained silent on the many concessions made to the Tel Aviv during the Trump administration, leading Israel to believe that the new administration's policies won't differ much from that of the former president. In the first volume of his presidential memoir, A Promised Land, Barack Obama writes about the pressure exerted from the Israeli lobbies. He wrote that American politicians who criticized Israel policy too loudly risk being tagged as anti-Israel and possibly anti-Semitic, and were confronted with a well-funded opponent in the next election. He added that Israel's supporters in the U.S. use accusations of anti-Semitism to stifle criticism of the regime's policies against the Palestinians. The former U.S. president further hit out at the pro-Israeli lobby, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, saying that the group moved to the right ideologically to mirror Netanyahu's administration and defended Israel even when its actions were contrary to U.S. policy. Obama also wrote that while congressional Republicans did not care about Palestinians' rights, their Democratic counterparts were, quote, worried about angering AIPAC and losing its support. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he opposes West Bank settlements construction in line with an international consensus that Israeli structures in the occupied Palestinian lands violate international law. He has further vowed to return to the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which Trump abandoned in May 2018. In such a political climate, as described in Obama's memoir, Biden will be fighting an uphill battle should he decide to overturn any of Trump's policies on Israel.
Frankly, I think that Biden is afraid of trying to reverse any of these. And why take a chance? Israel's happy with it, just leave it alone. That's the way he looks at it.
Only time will tell whether Biden, who faces numerous challenges both from the inside and abroad, would choose to risk his political career, which culminated in his presidency, by going against Israel's agenda.
On Wednesday, Joe Biden was sworn in as the 46th President of the United States. In his first speech as the U.S. President, he pledged to defeat political extremism and domestic terror.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
2 days later, Biden ordered the Director of National Intelligence to work with the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security conduct a comprehensive assessment of the threat from domestic violent extremism.
We're committed to developing policies and strategies based on facts, on objective and rigorous analysis, and on our respect for constitutionally protected free speech and political activities. Our initial work on DVE will broadly fall into three areas. The first is a tasking from President Biden sent to the ODNI today, requesting a comprehensive threat assessment coordinated with the FBI and DHS on domestic violent extremism.
The fast-paced move shows how seriously the new U.S. administration is taking the issue in the aftermath of the January 6th demonstration in which pro-Trump protesters overran the Capitol. The National Intelligence Office was created in 2001 after the September 11 attacks with the goal of combating international terrorism. The involvement of the National Intelligence Office suggests that U.S. authorities are examining how to pivot to a more concerted focus on violence from extremists at home.
People in the U.S. who don't want any more wars, who want money to be used for poverty and homelessness here, those people are now going to be cracked down on with the same policies that they're using to the right-wing extremists. And so I think it took a while for the Biden administration and the Democrats to do this, because I think now they're also going to use it to attack people on the anti-imperialist left, the anti-war left, who don't want any conflict abroad.
What happened in the U.S. Capitol raised questions about whether federal government national security apparatus that for decades has moved aggressively to combat what it called threats from foreign terror groups is adequately equipped to address the threat of domestic terrorism. In U.S. Congress, lawmakers passed a measure requiring intelligence agencies to work on annual reports and strategic assessments of domestic extremism. Many lawmakers blame far-right white supremacist extremism as the most dangerous threat in America. Indeed, they have evidence for their claim. A report conducted by the Center for Strategic and International Studies shows that white supremacists and other far-right groups conducted two-thirds of the terrorist plots and attacks in the U.S. in 2020. It says that anarchists and other like-minded extremists orchestrated 20% of the plots and attacks, although the number of incidents grew from previous years. These groups mostly targeted law enforcement, military, and government facilities and personnel. Last August, Michael German, a former FBI special agent, published a report in which it said white supremacist groups have infiltrated U.S. law enforcement agencies in every region of the country over the last two decades. The report said U.S. law enforcement officials have been tied to racist militant activities in more than a dozen states since the year 2000. It noted that hundreds of police officers have been caught posting racist and bigoted social media content. The report said the main reason U.S. law enforcement have failed to respond to far-right domestic terror threats is that they are involved in such crimes.
From the very beginning, the U.S. state intelligence apparatus, whether it's domestic or foreign, the FBI, the CIA, has been based entirely on the enslavement of African people, of indigenous peoples. And so this notion that Biden and the Democrats are going to crack down on racism within and try to eradicate it is kind of nonsense, because at its very core, the U.S. state has been repressive, has been based on colonialism, slavery.
Concerns about alleged relations between far-right groups and law enforcement in the U.S. have intensified since the start of the protest movement sparked by the police killing of George Floyd in the summertime. But when footage of the protest rally on January 6 showed some police officers were letting protesters enter the building, the authorities started to worry. Investigation shows that there were off-duty officers in the rally and helped others to storm the Capitol building. A poll conducted by Reuters news agency after the insurrection at the Capitol found that 12% of Americans have supported the move. With their enormous power, department-issued weapons, and access to sensitive information, police departments have become attractive recruiting grounds for white supremacist groups. Because of the secretive nature of such groups, it is hard to say how many officers are involved. But since 2009, police officers in dozens of U.S. states have been identified as members of white supremacist groups.
It seems that as Britain left the European Union at the end of last year, the inevitable was going to happen to the British economy as a direct consequence of Brexit, with goods, services and business essentially halting their flow between London and the EU, leaving the British economy gasping for air. Add to this the devastating impact of the COVID-19 virus, which has placed the country into its third lockdown, and there's no doubt that Britain is entering a double-dip recession as COVID-19 cases surge across Britain. With the full impact of Brexit yet to be felt until the end of the first quarter of 2021, the end of 2020 saw the British economy sink by some 2.6%, leaving it easy to predict that things will get a lot worse come spring as Britain sinks further into misery. The cases of COVID-19 in the UK has put the country at the top of the global list when it comes to the worst death rate in the world, with daily death rates in the last few days fluttering around the 2,000 mark, meaning the knock-on effect towards the economy is proving to be equally as fatal. All eyes are now on the UK from Brussels and the rest of Europe to study how they're faring since their departure from the bloc, with many keen to show that by leaving the EU, the future does not look bright, and it's hence aimed at discouraging others to emulate a Brexit of their own. Yet Germany, and in particular Deutsche Bank, have looked at the British economy and concluded that three major factors have contributed to the decline, with two of the main reasons coming from the impact of Brexit rather than that of COVID-19, something that the British will not care to admit. So just how big a fall will the second dip be for Britain? Will it be worse than the first one? And just how long will it take the UK to climb out of a very deep, dark and slippery hole that it's found itself in?
Well, GDP will shrink, likely between 5 and 25%. Depends on how long this lockdown will last, and we have now indications it will be another extension and another extension and another extension, as happened throughout 2020, where initially we were told it was going to be 2 weeks. It turned out to be longer than 2 weeks, so we have to expect most of 21 is going to be a lockdown year. And that will, in that case, of course, we have to look at the bigger figures of GDP contraction, 25 to 30%.
Much like Britain, the EU has felt the impact of the COVID-19 virus. But unlike Britain, the EU has a multitude of industries and services that it can rely on to contribute to the economy, to sway things back into the black in times of crisis. Yet it seems that so heavy is the impact of the third wave of the pandemic been on the EU that the financial commitments made by Brussels have not caught up with the Eurozone, which could see as many as 19 EU states fall into a deeper recession as a result. Already signs are looking bleak for the EU, with the zone seeing its Purchasing Managers Index, or PMI, fall to below 50 points to 49.1, indicating a serious downturn in economic activity, sparked by the stringent lockdowns rolling out again across the EU. But the EU has demonstrated the ability to work together to find solutions. The 2008-2009 global crash was a fine example of such camaraderie. But with things taking an impact on a much larger scale this time round, will coming out of another recession prove to be more demanding this time round?
No, I mean, you know, that's not any more difficult. The problem is, why are we shrinking the economy artificially by shutting down everything and prohibiting business activity? Why are we restricting individual freedoms, and why are we particularly annihilating small and medium-sized enterprises, particularly in service sector, catering,
all sorts of face-to-face type of businesses. Is this justified? Where's the cost-benefit analysis? There's never been any, and it doesn't make sense. And of course, the longer you do this, the bigger the contraction.
The future ahead now falls in the hands and arms, it seems, of the people of Europe, as various vaccines are deployed to try and stop the virus once and for all. Yet the sheer logistical scale of such an operation, coupled with the already crippling effect on the economy caused by the virus, will mean that many more will suffer before things start to return to any notion of normality for Europe.
Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio. The leadership of the Proud Boys has come under increased scrutiny as agents and prosecutors across the United States try to determine how closely members of the far-right nationalist group communicated during the riot at the Capitol this month, and to what extent they might have planned the assault in advance, according to federal law enforcement officials. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Francis Robles. The piece is titled Proud Boys Under Growing Scrutiny in Capitol Riot Investigation. Stay with us for more of Alan Feuer and Francis Robles' article. The leadership of the Proud Boys has come under increased scrutiny as agents and prosecutors across the United States try to determine how closely members of the far-right nationalist group communicated during the riot at the Capitol this month, and to what extent they might have planned the assault in advance, according to federal law enforcement officials. At least six members of the organization have been charged in connection with the riot, including one of its top-ranking leaders, Joseph Biggs. Mr. Biggs, a U.S. Army veteran, led about 100 men on an angry march from the site of President Donald J. Trump's speech towards and then into the Capitol building. The Proud Boys, who have a history of scuffling with left-wing anti-fascist activists, have long been some of Donald Trump's most vocal and violent supporters, and he has returned the favor, telling them during one of the presidential debates to stand back and stand by. Along with the right-wing militia, the Oath Keepers, the Proud Boys was one of the extreme groups with a large presence at the Capitol incursion, investigators said. Despite having launched one of the most sprawling inquiries in American history, investigators have yet to unearth clear-cut evidence suggesting there was a widespread conspiracy to assault the Capitol building on Wednesday, 6th of January. Still in recent days, they have turned their attention towards a pair of Proud Boy organizers on the West Coast and have started executing a series of search warrants connected to the group, a federal law enforcement official said, speaking on the condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to discuss an ongoing inquiry. One of the organizers of Proud Boys, Ethan Nordin of Auburn, Washington State, appeared with Mr. Biggs in a YouTube video on the day Donald Trump's rally and can be seen shouting orders to a group of Proud Boys through a bullhorn. Ethan Nordin, also known as Rufio Panman, investigators said, is named in Mr. Biggs's criminal complaint but has not been charged himself. The second Proud Boy organizer, Eddie Block of Madera, California, took video of Mr. Biggs and Mr. Nordin during the event in Washington, according to a photograph included in Mr. Biggs's charging documents. In an hour-long YouTube video that he live-streamed this weekend, Mr. Block acknowledged that about 25 federal agents swooped down on his house on Friday, seizing two of his cell phones, a laptop, an iPad, an Xbox, and an old computer. When reached by phone on Tuesday, 26th of January, Mr. Block declined to comment further on the federal investigation. Mr. Nordin could not be reached for comment. The FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, has acknowledged that it is conducting a similarly serious inquiry into the Oath Keepers. Oath Keepers are a group of largely composed of law enforcement and military personnel, and also the Three Percenters, which emerged from the extremist wing of the gun rights movement. Several members of both organizations have already been charged in connection with a Capitol attack, including three defendants who stand accused of the most severe conspiracy allegations leveled so far. FBI investigators involved in the Capitol attack have also focused their attention on the chairman of the Proud Boys, Enrique Tarrio. Mr. Tarrio, who lives in Miami, Florida, was scheduled to attend a march in Washington, but was thrown out of the city by a judge the day before it happened. When he was arrested on 4th of January in connection with the burning of a Black Lives Matter banner that had been torn from a historic black church during a different round of violent protests last month, police officers found he was carrying two high-capacity rifle magazines emblazoned with the Proud Boys chicken logo. Prosecutors have noted in documents attached to Mr. Biggs's case that Mr. Tarrio first began encouraging the Proud Boys to go to Washington for the Stop the Steal march in late December, when he posted a message on the social media app Parler announcing that members of the group would turn out in record numbers. In the run-up to the rally, Mr. Tarrio also used Parler to urge his members to avoid wearing their traditional black and yellow polo shirts, but instead to go incognito and move about the city in smaller teams, prosecutors say. In an interview with the New York Times 1 week after the siege, Enrique Tarrio, who took over the Proud Boys from its founder, Gavin McInnes, said that the attack on the Capitol was misguided and that anyone who broke windows or took part in the nearly 140 assaults on police officers should be prosecuted. He tried to minimize the role that the Proud Boys played in the attack on the Capitol building, even though among the 150 people charged so far, prosecutors have brought charges against Nicholas Oakes, the leader of the group's Hawaii chapter, and Nicholas DiCarlo, one of the top media figures. Dominic Pezzola, a Proud Boy from Rochester, New York, was in the first wave of rioters to breach the Capitol, prosecutors say, and stands accused of shattering a window with a plastic police riot shield. Obviously, they didn't help our cause, Enrique Tarrio said. Investigators are continuing to sift through online posts and messages by Enrique Tarrio and by Mr. Biggs in an effort to determine if they showed any attempt at coordination or planning of the attack on the Capitol building, according to federal law enforcement officials. On the day of the attack, Enrique Tarrio took to Parler, calling members of the Proud Boys who took part in his revolutionaries and urged them not to leave. "For now, I'm enjoying the show," he wrote, adding, "Do what must be done." While investigators are increasingly focused on people who may have pre-planned the attack, any evidence that the assault on the Capitol building was organized in advance could be a factor in Donald Trump's second impeachment trial, scheduled for early February in the U.S. Senate. House Democrats have accused the former president of inciting the riot, which led to the deaths of 5 people, including one Capitol police officer. Several defendants have said they joined the siege following Donald Trump's orders. But if proof emerges that groups like the Proud Boys or the Oath Keepers plotted in it in the days before it happened, it could undermine some arguments that Donald Trump is entirely to blame. On the other hand, evidence could end up showing that any pre-planned attack was inspired by weeks of the former president's insistence that the election was rigged.
Around the World with Reporters.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travelers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection, and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling, thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place. Lockdowns, curfews. But with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008, but it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Iran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus, plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then of course the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers Giuseppe Conte, who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic, Sergio Mattarella, to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It isn't certain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is